Welcome to ThoughtCast, an interview program on authors, academics, and intellectuals. Also podcast on the web at www.thoughtcast.org. I'm Jenny Atiyah. The science of husbandry, put into a pleasing dress. That's how John Dryden, the 17th century English poet, described Virgil's Georgics, a poem about farming. Dryden continues, in Virgil there's, quote, something of a rustic majesty, like that of a Roman dictator at the plow tail. He delivers the meanest of his precepts with a kind of grandeur. He breaks the clods and tosses the dung about with an air of gracefulness, end quote. And this poem, Dryden concludes, is the best poem by the best poet.
Iamque pedem referens, casus se vaseret omnis, reddite quao ridice, superas veniebat ad auras.
Now, it's not surprising that Virgil, who is arguably the greatest poet of ancient Rome, could turn any subject, even the meanest ones, into art. But why would he write about farming, about how to care for fields, crops, and animals? What's he got to do with clods and dung? Let's remember, Virgil wrote the Aeneid, the national epic of the Roman Empire. But beforehand, he wrote the Georgics, which means agriculture in Greek, although of course the poem's in Latin.
Terque fragos stagnis auditus avernis.
With me to discuss the Georgics is David Ferry, a noted poet in his own right, whose bilingual translation of the Georgics has recently been released. Welcome, David.
Hello.
Previously, David translated the first of Virgil's great poems called the Eclogues, as well as the Odes and Epistles of Horace, and the Babylonian epic poem Gilgamesh. We're also joined by Richard Thomas, a leading Virgil scholar and the chairman of Harvard University's Classics Department. Hello, Richard.
Hello.
Richard, in your research, you focused in particular on the Georgics, and you've written a two-volume commentary on the poem. Would you agree with Dryden that the Georgics is indeed the best poem by the best poet?
Certainly, since I quoted that passage at the beginning of my commentary and endorsed it fully. I think it's in some ways a mature poem of Virgil. It's a finished poem of Virgil. The Aeneid, of course, is a great poem, but there's something about the time in Virgil's life, his maturity, but still connected to his youth, that I think makes it both exciting and finished. It's not quite a classic, so some of the oddities of it, I think, make it more interesting than the classic can become, or the classic in its reception can become. And I think, particularly in the 18th century, for instance, partly because Dryden's translation of the Aeneid made that poem into such a royalist poem, the Aeneid suffered in popularity, whereas the Georgics came on through the 18th century. But the Aeneid has always asserted itself as the classic, in part because it's about foundation and about Rome. And so the Georgics, to some extent, has taken, along with the Eclogues, a secondary place.
David, you collaborated with Richard a bit in writing your translation.
I got a lot of help from him.
What was the process like?
The process was showing what I'd done to Richard and getting him to tell me where I'd gone wrong and encourage me where he was sympathetic, which he certainly almost always was. My reading of the Georgics is, of course, very much influenced by the way Richard and some other scholars have written about it. In a sense, it seems to me that in my introduction, I say it is the fundamental poem, and I mean by that culture, human culture and the culture of the animals and plants and so on, is always under threat in the poem and is always celebrated for its resistance to those threats and pitied for its vulnerability.
If I could just jump in here, it's also the case that the form of the Georgics somewhat belies much of its content. I think it presents itself as a didactic poem. But it is not, I think, intended, to use that slippery word, to teach small farmers how to farm. They would, if they could read Latin, they would have read the prose treatises that were around. And so, as David suggests, I think the Georgics, or the topic of Tara Georgica, the working of the soil, functions as a metaphor for existence after the fall, the Roman, Greco-Roman version of that, after the Golden Age, after spontaneity has dried up and man has to confront as sometimes hostile natural world.
Let's look at the text here. There's a passage in the first book of the Georgics that I think captures in part what the poem's about. The one about Jupiter and the deadly poison. David, will you read from your own translation?
It was Jupiter who put the deadly poison into the fangs of serpents, commanded the wolf to seek and find its prey, ordained that the storm should cause the sea to rise and flood the land, stripped from the leaves of oaks the dew-like honey that made them glisten there, hid fire from man, turned off the flow of wine that everywhere ran in the streams. All this, so want should be the cause of human ingenuity, and ingenuity the cause of arts, finding little by little the way to plant new crops by means of plowing and strike the spark to ignite the hidden fire in veins of flint. Then rivers began to sense that hollow canoes were floating upon their waters. Sailors began to count the stars in the sky and give them names, Pleiades, Hyades, Arctos, starry child of Lycaon. And then they learned to snare wild beasts in traps and fool songbirds with lime. Here one man lashes the river with his line, seeking the depths, and there another drags his dripping fishnet through the ocean waters. Then came the hardness of iron, and then the shriek of the sharp blade of the saw as it made its way, for earlier men used wedges to cleave their wood. Then followed other arts, and everything was toil, relentless toil, urged on by need.
That's really quite a passage. But the passage has a darkness to it. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that the Georgics bounces back and forth between celebration in nature and in man's accomplishments in taming it, and a much more brooding, despairing description of the reality of life. Richard, what is Virgil trying to do here?
Well, again, in the mythology of the Golden Age or the Metallic Ages, we are situated in the Age of Iron, which is a debased age when the gods no longer walk the earth. So in that setting, agriculture is enforced on mankind. Plowing is a necessity, as David's reading brings out. Plowing has to occur because the earth no longer delivers. And there are obviously advantages to that, but it's also a dire situation. The lines that follow say precisely what will happen if you don't pursue toil. You'll be left looking at the in the woods for acorns. This is over on page 15. If I could just read, David, if he doesn't mind here. Therefore, unless you take up your hoe, attacking the enemy weeds over and over again, and over again, shout at the birds to scare them away, and use your pruning knife to keep on cutting back the overgrowth that threatens your plants with shade, you will, alas, end up defeated, staring at your neighbor's granary full of corn, and in the woods you'll shake the oak tree, frantic for something to eat. So this is the reality of the world for Virgil, and it's a reality that infuses this poem, and is also a very controversial passage. Everything was toil, relentless toil, urged on by need. Then there's a whole scholarship on those lines, because poets such as Dryden, such as Day Lewis, who did the last poetic translation, it's very deficient against the realities of Virgil, such translators can't provide a translation relentless, but that's what the Latin says, improbus. It's an ethical word. It means not upright, not straight dealing in some ways. And to translate that word can go against the grain of readings which simply see this poem, as Dryden largely did, as a celebration of the soil and a celebration of the farm.
Was this controversy one that the two of you engaged in? On this passage?
I can't remember. I mean, I remember, of course, engaging in it in your notes.
In my notes.
In your commentary. I can't remember whether you and I talked about
it. I'm not sure whether we did, but either way, David got it right. So, and I think, but given his reading of the poem.
Let's get back to the larger point of what the Georgics is about. I feel that it's neither black nor white. It is subtle. It explores the varieties of experience. A passage that's, I think, a good example of this is one of the cheerier passages in the poem at the beginning of book four. It's on finding a home for the bees, but it's also about death. David, could you read that section?
Yeah. What page is it?
It is on page 141.
Thanks. First of all, find a protected place for the bees to make their home, a place that's safe from the wind, that might prevent them from getting back with their food, and safe from the sheep or the wanton kids that trample the flowers down, or the wandering heifer shaking the dew from the grass and bruising the rising blades. Protect the rich stalls of their honeycombs from the scaly, shiny-backed lizard, and from the bee-eater and other birds of the sort, and Procne, whose bloody hands have left their signs upon her crimson breast. Any of these can devastate the bees, catching them in their mouths to carry them home as delicacies to feed to their cruel children.
Well, that does not end very cheerily. Richard, you have studied this poem inside and out. What do you see in this passage?
This is a fundamental part of the poem. It's the first half of the fourth book deals with the world of the bees, which really depart. The first three books are the three areas of agriculture: crops in book one, trees and vines in book two, livestock in book three. To have bees on a level with those in terms of the realities of agriculture is very much to magnify the position of bees. And of course, it's because they aren't simply bees. Virgil presents a society of bees as a particularly advanced type of society, which has affiliations now with very advanced human stages. They are fragile, obviously, in that they're small, but they go out to do battle. Virgil knew that a swarm of bees was not a battle, but he presents the swarm as if it is a battle, and he has the bees sharpening their stings, sharpening their weapons, so they become Roman soldiers. It's just a fascinatingly original poem, precisely where it will seem at its most technical or its most handbookish, in a sense. Again, you wouldn't use this to establish your beehive. There is an Irishman, I forget the name, who ran his farm according to Virgil's Georgics, and the farm failed, I think, within the first season.
You're listening to ThoughtCast, also podcast on the web at www.thoughtcast.org. I'm Jenny Attia. With me is Richard Thomas, a Virgil scholar and chairman of Harvard's Classics Department, and David Ferry, who's published a new translation of Virgil's Georgics, a poem about farming. Virgil wrote the Georgics at a volatile time in Roman history. Julius Caesar had been murdered in 44 BC, and what followed was a sporadic civil war. Lands were abandoned, crops were burned. Richard, what impact does this political backdrop have on the poem?
It has a vital impact, really, on every line of the poem, not just the events of 44, but if we take Virgil's birth and look at essentially the tumultuous state in which the Roman world and Italy had been off and on from his sort of early teens, we see a poet being formed in dangerous times, in times where one city could fall to civil war and where bloodshed was rampant, where street gangs, street warfare was again a fact of daily life. So that Virgil writes in a context, he writes also on either side of the Battle of Actium, the battle at which, after which, as Sir Ronald Syme put it, the last warlord was left standing, that is Octavian, soon to be Augustus Caesar, though, after the actual composition of the Georgics.
And Octavian had defeated Mark Antony of Cleopatra fame
exactly.
in that battle.
Yes, yes, precisely. And so, although again, as Syme has said, it wasn't clear where history was going and where the world was going, but it was clear what had been lost, and what had been lost clearly was a republic. It must have been fairly clear to Virgil even in these times. But what had been gained also was security, and I think one finds this tension, particularly in the passages that we can place after the Battle of Actium, tension between a hope for the future, a hope that civil war is ended, and that hope is reflected in the places where Octavian Augustus appears at the beginning of the third book and the end of the fourth, but the darkness of vision that clearly is part of Virgil's power never, I think, departs from the poem, which is why the Orpheus passage stands where it is. So I think his times clearly are tied up with his genius, his choice of subject, his focus throughout.
You mentioned Orpheus, the story of whom pretty much wraps up the poem. It's included, wrapped within another tale of the beekeeper Aristaeus. And David, when you were at the Harvard Bookstore recently giving a talk, you actually read a very moving passage from this section. Orpheus has gone to the underworld to seek the release of Eurydice. Through the power of his song, his music, he wins her freedom, and they're heading up to the light, back to earth. Let's listen to it.
And now, as he was carefully going back the way he came, and step by step avoiding all possible wrong steps, and step by step, Eurydice, whom he was bringing back, unseen, behind his back, was following, for this is what Proserpina had commanded. They were coming very near the upper air, and a sudden madness seized him, madness of love, a madness to be forgiven if hell but knew how to forgive. He stopped in his tracks, and then, just as they were just about to emerge out into the light, suddenly, seized by love, bewildered into heedlessness, alas, his purpose overcome, he turned and looked back at Eurydice. And then and there, his labor was spilled and flowed away like water. The implacable tyrant broke the pact. Three times the pool of Avernus heard the sound of thunder. What was it, she cried? What madness, Orpheus, was it that has destroyed us, you and me? Oh, look, the cruel fates already call me back, and sleep is covering over my swimming eyes. Farewell, I'm being carried off into the vast surrounding dark and reaching out my strengthless hands to you forevermore, alas, not yours. And saying this, like smoke disintegrating into air, she was dispersed away and vanished from his eyes, and never saw him again. And he was left clutching at shadows with so much still to say.
It's such an empathetic passage. Mm-hmm. Richard, in telling the story of Orpheus and Eurydice, is Virgil really telling us about ourselves, about our attempts to master and cultivate our own nature, like he is attempting to teach the farmer how to master and cultivate nature?
I think that's definitely one of the things he's teaching us, and as David's translation brings out, what is it that is lost? It's the labor, again, it's the toil of Orpheus. Why? Because of an emotional doubt, because of his humanity. He looked back, and it's, of course, that failure, which is an understandable failure, as Virgil says, if the shades knew how to forgive or to understand.
David, what happens next in this section, in your translation?
Let me read a passage that follows on this. And it is said that he, day after day, for 7 months beside the river Streamon, sat underneath a towering cliff and wept and sang and told in song his story. Entranced, the wild beasts listened. Entranced,
the oak trees moved closer to hear the song, which was like that of the nightingale in the shade of a poplar tree, in mourning for her children, who were taken as yet unfledged by a herdsman, hard of heart, who had happened upon the nest. She weeps all night, and over repeats her lamentation, and fills the listening air with her sad complaint.
We have the Virgil in hexameters in the Latin, and we have David's in iambic pentameter. And we know that John Dryden also has translated the Georgics, a famous translation in heroic couplets. Mm. Let's compare the two passages and see how yours is different, is similar to his.
The Dryden, just let me read the Dryden passage. For 7 continued months, if fame say true, the wretched swain his sorrows did renew. By streamin's freezing streams he sat alone. The rocks were moved to pity with his moan. Trees bent their heads to hear him sing his wrongs. Fierce tigers crouched around and lolled their fawning tongues. So, close in poplar shades, her children gone, the mother nightingale laments alone, whose nest some prying churl had found, and thence by stealth conveyed the unfeathered innocence. But she supplies the night with mournful strains, and melancholy music fills the plains. Now, for one thing, the way that alone moan applied to Orpheus's music, and then gone and alone, in a sense, makes the analogy between Orpheus and the nightingale brought home in music, in a sense, and validated by the writing of the line. Not writing in heroic couplets, that resource is unavailable to me. The marvelous word, but she supplies the night with mournful strains, in a sense. Those two Latin verbs don't appear in the Virgil, but in Dryden's interpretation of the lines there. She fills up the night, supplies. This is an archaic sense of supplies that we don't have. That's just not there for me.
Richard, how do you see these two sections of the poem? How do you compare them?
This is a fundamental part of the poem, I think, particularly in this simile. And I take issue only with one word of David, which I should have taken issue with earlier. That is the word herdsman, which in the Latin is a plowman, in fact. And what it primarily takes us back to is apparently a very mundane part of the poem in Book 2, that is the bird simile, where Virgil is describing what could be more mundane. He's describing the best sort of soil types.
And these but he does it beautifully.
These are the passages that tend not to get read, or they tend to get accepted in curricula. That is, I'll tell you the best sort of soil. And this is on David's page 63. So there are various sorts of soil that are best, but one that is best is, I'll read it if you don't mind, or David, maybe if you could just read, a soil like that is almost always the best.
Okay. A soil like that is almost always the best for growing grain. Nowhere else will you see so many loaded wagons making their way slowly back to their homes behind their bullocks. Or there's the land the angry plowman clears by cutting down the groves that stood untouched for many years and carrying off the wood and pulling up the roots of the ancient homes of birds that now unnested seek the sky, and the virgin field lies shining under the plowshare.
Yes, so that Virgil is telling us ostensibly what is the best sort of soil, that is, the one on which we've been for it. But he can't simply say that. That's not his poetic vision. He focuses on what's lost, and we as readers can focus on the virgin field lies shining under the plowshare, ready to receive a crop, or we can focus on what is lost, the unnested bird. And I think when Virgil comes back to that in the simile for Orpheus, we suddenly see the direct relationship between the agricultural and the mythical, that Orpheus in his loss is the nightingale that the plowman has disrupted and has evicted in the service of civilization, in the service of agriculture.
We've been talking about Virgil's vision in this poem, and also David Ferry's vision, and for a short while, Dryden's vision. I'm wondering, Richard, do any of the translations, either of those, for example, add anything to the Latin, the original? Is there anything you, as an expert, can glean from a translation? Do you see anything that gives you insight into the original poem when you read such a translation?
Outrage.
It's a difficult question. I mean, it's been said that poetic translation is an impossibility. One can't translate poetry, and there's truth to that. But without translation, we are lost. A world in which everybody could read Virgil would be, to me, an admirable world, but not a realistic world.
David, you've written several books of your own poetry, most recently one titled Of No Country I Know, New and Selected Poems and Translations. In your translation of the Georgics, how much of it is Virgil and how much of it is you, your voice?
I don't think you can write lines without it being, in some sense or other, your own voice. That's one thing to say. I think a second thing to say is that any translation is a reading of the poem that it's translating, and therefore it's over there in your voice of necessity, in a sense. I've given a number of talks about translation. The title of every one of them is Not Getting It Right. It is, I think, of the nature of translating.
I noticed a poem of yours about Eurydice. Mm-hmm. Was it Eurydice at the bus stop?
Mm-hmm.
Would you read it for us?
Oh, this is a very short 8-line poem. It's just about seeing an old lady on our street corner in Ellery Street being taken away by the bus, in a sense. And the old lady's face, who knows whose it was? The bus slid by me. Who in the world knows me? She was amazed, amazed. Can death really take me? The bus went away. It took the old lady away.
Hmm. Are we going to be hearing from you in the future? Will you be applying your talents to the Aeneid, a new translation?
I'm 81 years old. It's a long poem, I don't think so.
Richard, what about you? What can we expect from you in terms of scholarship? Have you had enough of Virgil? I believe you're turning to Horace.
Well, I feel 81 years old at the end of this semester, but yes, I'm doing a commentary on the fourth book of the Odes of Horace, but I never can get away from Virgil completely, and in fact, I'm doing a short article on Robert Lowell's on falling asleep over Aeneid. Mm. Aeneid 11, which I found some interesting things in. So Virgil stays with me, but Horace for the time being.
Well, David, Richard, thank you both very much.
You're welcome.
You're welcome.
You've been listening to ThoughtCast, also podcast on the web at www.thoughtcast.org. I'm Jenny Atiya, and I welcome your thoughts on Virgil, the Georgics, animal husbandry. Just go to the site and click on the link for Virgil's Georgics. You can take it from there. Thanks for joining us.